In his dreams, the snouted things chased him, limbless bodies covered in worms. The hyenas circled under the venom tree, shaggy with their freight of bloodsuckers. The tiny worms that filled the sex air and had invaded his pores had smaller worms to bite them. He woke with a shuddering start. Nibblers? Sippers? Cute names for unappeasable horrors. We folk, good folk, trooping all together. Parasites are everywhere, far too many of the bastards on Earth. But if Sek'ul hadn't found him, what an appalling fate. But she didn't find me, he thought. She was watching me. Your fall saved your life, but at a cost. He opened his eyes. She was beside him in her tripod pose, wearing the headset. She smiled at him. He'd come to like that eerie, too-wide smile very much. But it had an edge to it, on which he feared to cut himself. I must return your gear. She handed over everything, including the pellet gun, which he'd assumed was lost or confiscated. That is not a lethal weapon, she remarked. You carry none. What if you'd run into trouble, John Forrest? What kind of trouble, he wondered. Friends of yours? What if I did? Thou shalt not kill. I'm on a fact-finding mission. I'm not at war with anyone. A fact-finding mission, she repeated. Indeed. I see. What about you, Sek'ul? I'm deeply in your debt, of course, but what are you doing in this hellhole? How did you happen to turn up like that?
The surface is a source of raw materials, John Forrest. We come here to make deals with the indigenes and squabble with each other over the spoils. I was researching tree venoms that can be weaponized, if you must know.
It's no work for a doctor.
We live in the dark as well as the bright, Mr. From the Sky, and though I chose medicine, I was born to something else. I saw you run from the vermin, I saw you climb, then fall. It was pure chance.
Now I know too much, thought Forrest. And whatever the hell's going on, I get the feeling I'm in serious trouble. But you'd spare me if you could, for which I thank you.
He said nothing, just nodded gravely. I'll be leaving soon, she said. Here you have everything you need, and no sippers or nibblers can reach you. The hollows under the great hearts are our safe houses. I'll give you a homing beacon, since you have none, to guide you back to the spot where I found you. But you are very ill. Please wait. Eat, rest, and exercise a while before leaving. I'm not happy about the way you keep falling asleep in the daytime.
Oh, that? We call it jet lag. It's nothing. It's just taking me a while to adjust to a different time zone. Forrest liked to wear a wristwatch. He collected them. Before leaving for West Africa, he'd had one specially made for this trip. An ingenious, expensive toy. Instead of hours and seconds, it followed the intricate dance of the orbits of the two planets. Sek'ul had returned this device. He didn't think she could have tampered with it. As he spoke, he read the time, the only time that mattered to him, and his heart skipped a beat. He wanted to ask her, just how long was I very ill? How long is your world day right now? He had no idea how to frame the question, and it didn't matter. He knew enough of Patola's complex requirements to be sure he'd missed his window. His next chance wouldn't be coming around for quite a while.
But, John Forrest, I have a proposal. It suddenly struck me. Why not come to the clouds? You're on a fact-finding mission. I could introduce you to interesting people, and later we could surely set you down wherever you need to be.
Forrest slipped the orrery watch into an inside pocket. Her big green eyes were limpid with lies. Her smile had that bleak, warning edge, and he didn't care. What a wonderful idea. I'd be delighted. When do we leave? If he was stranded, for a year and a half or forever, he might as well see the world.
stir things up in this story he didn't understand. Why not? If Lizard Woman feared for his life, maybe she just didn't know John Forrest very well. But that pouch on the cord around her neck, where she kept her oracle bones, what was going on there? She was making arrangements for his visit. Forrest had fallen asleep in the daytime again. The room was dim. The lights that stood in wall niches were at their lowest setting. He heard Sekhul's voice, but she was nowhere in sight. She'd screened off an area at the end of the room, the way she used to screen his bed sometimes when he was sick. The headset lay on a table. Intrigued, he donned it and sneaked up to the screens, creeping around until he could peer between them. He saw himself, standing naked, quivering, full frontal. The shock was momentary. He was looking as if into a full-length, freestanding mirror, but it was a mirror that didn't reflect the room he was in. The naked figure was a hologram. A stranger, a lizard man, though he couldn't see a tail, stood by the hollow, dressed in black and white. Sekhul, her back to Forrest, spoke rapidly in a language that crackled and fizzed like fireworks, but reached him as English, mostly.
No, he's an original, not any kind of Flesha Titanaton. But he's carrying an implant attached to his stomach wall. I haven't touched it, and I don't know what it's for.
Good to know I'm still a walking interplanetary probe, thought Forrest. Lizard Man's contribution over the video link was incomprehensible.
Deniable is good, but how long could it stand up? This is better. Far better than a kin-snipping, Ezbui. We want to avoid reprisals, don't we?
Her tail, he thought, should be lashing. He'd have liked to see that. He retreated, replaced the headset where he'd found it, and laid down again, his thoughts racing. Feigning sleep, he must have dozed. He woke when he heard something crawling. The globes were still dim, the screens had been dismantled. Sekhul sat by the fireball, tail around her feet. Nothing moved, but the sound of crawling was closer. Puzzled, Forrest turned on his side, as if in sleep, and saw something come through the wall of the room. It crossed the floor. A male human figure, slender and juvenile, naked and very battered, hauling himself along on one hand and one knee, back, ribs, and shoulders marked with livid weals. Bruises blotted out his eyes. No sign of a tail, which made Forrest think he was asleep and dreaming of a human boy, except that the whole thing was too complete, too coherent. The kid's hair was dark, his greenish skin unnaturally pale, until he reached the firelight. Then he was more than pale. He was translucent, transparent. A mangled corpse, but moving, the apparition crept into Sekhul's arms. Another hologram? Not the way Sekhul responded. Not the way she held the kid, rocked him, and murmured to him, stroking his shadow hair from his swollen, battered shadow brow. Then somehow Forrest made a sound. She looked up. Instantly, the ghost was gone.
What was that? He breathed.
Enormous eyes unblinking, she calmly left the fire and picked up the translation device.
My son, Gemin. He comes to me when it's quiet. Usually I'm alone. You've never woken before. He died under torture. Don't die under torture, John Forrest. It's not a good way to go.
She removed the headset and turned away. The subject was closed. Forrest got up and joined her by the fireball, collecting the headset on the way. He held her gaze, deliberately settling the flexible web around his skull.
Tell me, Sekhul.
She looked into the flames, drawing her tail more closely around her.
There's not much to tell. He was caught up in the secret war and taken hostage. We failed to negotiate his release. He was mistreated. Our protests achieved nothing. We learned that he died. There's nothing to be done. I only comfort him and quiet him as best I can. Death is not the end, John Forrest, as we all know, because our dead return. They speak to us and know us, in dream and in the waking world. But when they depart at last, we don't know what happens next. We don't know if the unquiet ones, trapped in the way they died, escape from suffering at last. It's cruel.
I know you're a shaman, he said. There must be something you can do.
Her long fingers closed on the bag of bones. No. Let's say no more about it. I can't help my boy. He'll fade, that's all, and he'll be gone, and I won't know where.
Chapter 2. Out of the frying pan, into the fire. On their way out, Sekhul had to placate the demons again. Forrest kept his distance and didn't stir until she'd made her circuit. She seemed self-conscious, something he'd never seen in her before, and he liked it. He had no doubt that, if he'd asked, she'd tell him that of course she planned to disarm the venom-spitting fence if she'd been leaving him behind to await those kinsnippers. He said nothing. He just followed her, as before, grinning to himself. No longer helpless baggage. In charge of his own destiny again, and it felt good. But surely, subtly, everything had changed. Had the trees actually moved? Surely the spaces between the ranks were different. The uncertain ground had new contours.
Happens all the time, said Sekhul, catching his bewildered glances. The Sek is a single organism. It shifts about as it pleases. That's why there are no trails. The indigenes have their own ways to get around. We use our beacons and come in on foot. It's simpler.
What a world. It's like a circle in Dante's hell.
Indeed. All death in life is here, eating its own tail. Yet, somehow I love it.
There was a wind blowing outside the wood. They could hear it.
Sekhul gave Forrest a robe like her own. He wrapped himself, the folds settling firmly round his head and face, and they emerged from tepid stillness into a dust storm.
Well protected but half blind, he felt a hard surface under the skidding grit and glimpsed big squared and domed shapes. Fighting the wind to look behind him, he saw the Sek, rising like a gray-green mirage on the edge of a desert-devoured town. She headed for an intact building and used a touchpad to open massive double doors. In a covered courtyard, a welcome silence, she bared her face.
I have a call to make. It won't take long.
The room they entered made Forrest think of a chapel. A podium for the minister, benches for the congregation. Images of lizard people, animal and vegetable flourishes in colored metals or enamel covered the walls. She approached the podium. Forrest took a seat. His legs were too long. Sekhul was tall, but like a Japanese woman, her height was in her pliant body. Expecting a video link, he saw, to his astonishment, powdery matter begin to whirl inside a clear cylinder, building something from the platter upward. The cylinder withdrew, and there stood a solid, masculine-seeming human figure, Venusian style, a lizard man. Not the guy Forrest had seen in the mirror screen, someone new. He had scanty head hair. He wore some kind of dress uniform. He seemed authoritative but old, maybe sick. Sekhul spoke, lizard man mainly listened. At one point, he looked over her shoulder, and Forrest, disconcerted, felt eyes on him, a presence in the instant simulacrum. Finally, Sekhul bowed. The old guy did the same. The body crumbled and vanished. She walked past Forrest, resuming her headset as she headed for the doors.
Who is that?
My husband. Excuse him if he seemed rude. You'll meet him properly up above. Do you have wives, John Forrest?
I've had two, and I gave up.
wise man. I did what was expected of me. I gave a powerful old man my baby's name, his futurity for our security. A fair trade on both sides. We didn't expect it would be forever. I have no complaints, none at all. But oh, he's a long time dying.
She flashed him that eerie smile.
Now we need to hurry. The wind usually eases at nightfall, but I want to be far from here by then.
In the covered yard, Sekhu left him and swiftly reappeared, leading an extraordinary animal. A low-slung, big-haunched, tan-hided, wrinkly camel with bulbous cat's eyes, a sinuous neck and tail, a muzzle thick with stiff, drooping whiskers.
John Forrest, meet Mihanok. I don't take him into the sec, but we need him now. You'll have to ride behind me, I'm afraid. I wasn't expecting to bring home a guest.
Who had harnessed Mihanok? He listened. Not a footstep, not a voice. Are we alone? Where is everybody?
Only the indigenes live permanently on the surface, and around here they don't leave the haunted woods. Let's go. It's a long ride to the Seamount station.
If anybody asks, he thought, the ground staff never saw me. The cat camel's paces were challenging. He loped like a hare, pushing off from his big haunches, landing with an insouciant bounce on his forepaws. So far, so uncomfortable. Then he put on speed. At every leap, Forrest, with muttered curses, nearly lost his seat. At every touchdown, his tailbone tried to send his cervical vertebrae through the top of his head. Sekhul rode with her tail tucked up, stirrups high as a jockey's. She glanced around, green eyes vivid between folds of gray and the whipping dust, registering his discomfort. She faced ahead again, and he felt a curious, thrilling muscular movement. She was wrapping her tail around him.
Is that better?
Yes, he breathed. That's fine. Gradually, the howling died and the dust cleared. Mihanok seemed to feel he'd done enough. He ambled along a rudimentary trail, uphill, between eroded boulders that blocked the view to a bluff like a wave crest. Sekhul tapped his shoulder with the knotted end of her reins. The beast knelt, and they dismounted. They climbed the last few meters to a viewpoint and suddenly faced a staggering gulf. Red-gold cliffs plunged, way deeper than the Grand Canyon, into the haze of a basin that stretched forever. To their left, far below the bluff, Forrest saw the trail continuing to another complex of buildings and skeletal bridgework that reached out over the abyss to a rocky, conical pillar. Narrowing his eyes, he saw the sequence repeated, a string of rocky cones rising from unseen depths and the bridgework linking them becoming tiny and vanishing. Directly ahead, but far off, brilliant whiteness reflected the pale clouds.
Is that the ocean out there?
Once upon a time, said Sekhul. It's mostly a big salt pan now. We live in the clouds and in the skies, John Forrest, where everything is fine. Only fanatics think it matters that we can't live on the surface anymore if we wanted to. Which is just as well. The situation down here is beyond repair anyway.
So what's the use of worrying? It never was worthwhile.
Indeed. I'd like to learn your language. From what I can tell, it has a fine turn of phrase, many interesting concepts. Thou shalt not kill. There's another of them.
Forrest nodded, his thoughts very far away. Out of the frying pan, into the fire. Our beautiful neighbor planet before she ran into trouble?
Your calculations are slightly out, Patullo.
What caused the devastation?
Do your scientists have an explanation?
She thought about it, measuring her words.
Long ago, we lived in a dangerous world and didn't know it. Everything was kind, plenty was all around. One day, we stepped on a hidden switch, we pulled the wrong lever. We unknowingly tipped a balance, and destruction was set in motion, click-clack, like a child's toy. Sly, and comical and relentless. Or so I understand it. But we took that wrong step a very long time ago, John Forrest. The damage was done before we moved to the clouds, let alone the skies. It's nonsense to apportion blame.
The stillness after the wind, the somber majesty of the scene held them in silence.
I didn't bring you up here to accuse you of anything, Mr. From the Sky. There's something I wanted you to see, a trick of this landscape. Look to the east.
He felt the chill before he saw the cause. Far away and very distinct, like a bold line on a child's drawing, a dark ellipse appeared, stretching from horizon to horizon. It grew, like the shadow of the moon across the sun in a solar eclipse, contained, yet seeming liquid as ink. No flashes of radiance, no sunset colors heralded the change. The transition from light to shadow was perfectly abrupt, pure as a note of music. It was the dark. Forrest thought of a world without a visible sun. No moon, no stars. A horror ran through him. He wanted to run. At his shoulder, the Venusian sighed in delight as perfect night, velvet night, rose to the zenith and hurried down to engulf them.
There, she murmured when blackness lapped their vantage point.
Thank you, whispered Forrest. They rode to the Seamount station as if descending under miles of dark water. She'd fastened lights to Meehanhook's bridle, although he didn't seem to need them. He was sure-footed and at ease. The station was lit and as deserted as the town by the Sec. Their cable car, swinging from frictionless chains, black sides hung with rosy lights, reminded Forrest of an Egyptian ship of the dead on a temple frieze. It rode silently down to their platform. They embarked. Meehanhook had a compartment to himself. Sekh-ul made him comfortable, then joined Forrest in the stateroom, where a buffet offered store-cupboard foods, pickles, spreads, and tough breads, savory cakes of pressed beans, or insect larvae, crystallized fruit, a fine change from sappy gruel. They moved on, having eaten, to an observation car, taking along a carafe of spirits. The couches were soft and wide. They settled side by side.
Here's another sight not to be missed, John Forrest. We're passing over the trench.
In fathomless blackness, way down under them, he saw a vivid, active red line.
What's that? A rent in the world's hide, close to the old coastline where the fires of renewal pour out and worn-out flesh is devoured. It's shrinking. My city takes pictures. All the healthy wounds, as our scientists call them, are healing. It's not a good sign.
I've heard about that.
When the fire stops flowing, when the wounds are gone, then even the clouds and the skies may fail us. But that's a long way off. Neither you nor I need worry.
Forrest filled two tiny cups. She emptied hers and held it out for more. Like-for-like translation, he thought, turned them into a medieval knight and his lady, speaking of eldritch secret dooms known only to the wise. She tossed her cup aside and took his hand. Four-fingered, both outer digits opposable, she gripped like a chameleon.
This is a great favor you're doing for me.
A trip to the clouds? Forrest smiled to himself. It's my great pleasure.
Still, I feel I owe you. Let me give you some return.
There's no need.
Myself?
Well, now, that would be an unexpected bonus.
An interlude, I mean nothing more.
Of course not.
Romantic overtures would have been in poor taste, but his lust was honest, and however she squared it, her offer seemed honest too. Seeing no reason to refuse, he reached around and took the splendid root of her tail in a forthright, determined grip. The tongue that met his when they kissed was slender, strong, active, and probing.
The gulf behind her smile could have swallowed him whole. They shucked out of their clothes and embraced. Her tail lashed itself around him, and he probed in turn, deeper and longer than he'd have thought possible. Blissfully spent, he fell asleep, and woke still held in her grip, a silky, powerful frottage undulating up and down his thighs, his buttocks. He wondered if he would survive this dark journey or die happy. Unmeasured riches followed, an engrossing, fabulous interlude, only interrupted by the briefest of briefings for Forrest about her city. They hardly ate or drank. They slept coupled and entwined. But once, when he woke, he was alone. Sekhul was on the opposite couch, limbed in faint light, head bent over the oracle bones, the way he'd first seen her. He went over. She looked up, accepting, and drew back to let him see. Just four items, no bones. The slab, he remembered, was a paper-thin tablet, lit from within, marked in a grid of 4x4. Plenty for a tribal shaman, still living at the dawn of time. Not much of an apparatus to model the fate of a complex high-tech society. But 4x4 is a powerful number. "The tokens are relics from your own life," he said. "You've invested them with meaning, foretelling the fortunes of your people. That I understand. Will you explain how it works?" A fragment of patterned textile wrapped around three small flat sticks. What was? A shiny feather or fish scale set in silver wire. What might have been? Or better, the conditional, the always possible. A shriveled coil of brown, veiny material, probably a root fragment. What is? A black stone, glossy as obsidian, was the truth. The headset was nowhere in this exchange. He asked and she answered in gesture, the timeless, universal language of this other trade of hers. "Does what you read come true?" "If you know so much, you know that's a fool's question." Then she smiled. The black stone in one fist, she laid her free hand on his breast, where his heart was beating. "But when I know I'm right, however unbelievable, I'm right." Forrest felt suddenly very confused. Sekhul returned her tokens to the pouch and slipped the cord over her head. She was soon deeply asleep, but he lay awake. Sekhul, Sekhul, Woodsong the sorceress. Had he really understood her? It didn't seem possible. Their arrival at Tessera Station was as dramatic as Darkfall, in its way. Her city, a sky raft the size of Manhattan Island, had come to meet them. Moored by mighty hawsers, it stood at the sheer edge of the Tessera Plateau, beside the cable car buildings. Forrest watched the underbelly as they came in, a mass of swollen, membranous dirigibles, layered and roped together in a gargantuan netted frame. "Unlike the upper atmosphere habitats," Sekhul remarked, "our cities were developed from life. The original bladder raft colonies, which provide our germ material, still flourish, small as tables, big as mountaintops. We harvest and data mine them for improvements."
"Fascinating," said Forrest, making her laugh.
"About Gemin, you will be discreet."
"Of course."
She had told him that her city, Lakertan, led an alliance of liberal and independent cloud cities known as the Band. The other major bloc was an empire, run on military lines, centered on a vast skyraft called Rapton. Empire and Band were currently, technically, at peace, but the covert maneuvering was vicious. This was the situation that had cost Gemin his life. The dirty story hadn't been released. It was too inflammatory. The official line was that he'd been killed in a caving accident on an expedition to one of the old ocean beds, and tragically, it had been impossible to recover his body. "It was a prospecting expedition," said Sekhul,
in disputed territory where there are rich pickings, and they ran into trouble. He shouldn't have been there at all, of course. They disembarked, smiling for the welcoming committee, in their desert robes and battered wilderness clothes. The man from the sky was instantly surrounded by officials and Venusian-style media folk. He didn't speak to Sekhul again for a while. Forrest didn't get to watch the return of the Bright. Lekkertan was riding strong winds and everyone was indoors, sleeping or not. But after that, the city, which had been quiet as an Arctic night, began to bustle. Washed, brushed, and dressed in Venusian formal style, provided with fine accommodation and service, he was swept from reception to reception. He ate high-class delicacies, no better or worse than the same absurd fancy work in New York or London. He talked, in like-for-like translation, with many interesting Venusians, and had no trouble passing for a denizen of the upper atmosphere. Contact between the realms was minimal. He was their first actual visitor, a Marco Polo at the court of Kublai Khan. Perhaps the most personally interesting fact he picked up was that lizard men, like the naked ghost boy, had no tails, which explained a couple of things. He met Sekhul again at his private audience with the master of the city. The simulacrum he'd seen had been a flattering portrait. In life, the master was a wraith in a medicalized cocoon, though his eyes, appraising Forrest with great interest, were still sharp. Sekhul was at the bedside, in a dark blue formal gown, the first time he'd been close to her since the cable car. Raised on pillows, the master offered greetings translated by an aide wearing a headset. Forrest had arranged for the orrery watch to be boxed and wrapped in suitable style. He offered it with misgiving, hoping that the gift at least looked impressive, but the old man fizzed and crackled with a connoisseur's delight. "The master is pleased," reported the aide. "He says the orbits of our planet and our near neighbor present a pretty problem. He has never seen the puzzle worked in craft with such elegance and charm. He suggests you must twin your soul with my lady's brother, our chief scientist, who is also fascinated by the third world." Then the master was tired, and they were both dismissed. She donned a headset as soon as they were clear of the master's apartments. "I think you have no engagements just now, sir. Let me show you a view over the city." The view from the terrace was not dazzling. They were hemmed by blank walls and the defensive redoubt that protected the residence. But there was a glimpse of bright cloud above, and more rosy greenery than he'd seen elsewhere. "So that's my marriage," she said, pacing. "He was a good leader. Now he's old and deathly sick. But he's not senile, and he doesn't want to let go, so that's that. He's just forgotten how he's paralyzing me. Paralyzing the whole city." Her hair, grown out, ran in natural feathery cornrows to her nape. She wore classy makeup. There were jewels at her throat. The gown was daringly décolleté in the back, at the swell of her tail's root. But he missed her jungle pants. "You think I'm speaking very freely? Don't worry, everyone knows how I feel, including the master. Nobody's going to blab indiscretions in your company, John Forrest. These things," she tapped her headset, "are notoriously easy to hack." "What does the master think about what happened to your son?"
"That the accident was in disputed territory, and anything's better than war. That I can marry again when he dies and have other children. Or adopt, it's been done before. That he'll negotiate when he's stronger. Which will never happen. He's dying. I can't bear to tell him how real my son's suffering still is to me. So I just have to wait."
The people of Lekkertan, Forrest had learned, were a godless lot of sophisticated animists, like Sekhul herself. They were liberal, they were easy, but the idea of their prince lying untended, trapped in his death, at the bottom of some hole, gave them the horrors. And they weren't visited by that crawling corpse.
He knew he was talking to a desperate woman and forgave her many things.
What about my twin soul? Your brother, the chief scientist.
Ezbui. Who knows? He's an eccentric genius. He lives in a world of his own.
The smile he loved fought with the pain.
Enjoy the rest of your visit. You may not have been following the reckoning. We've come a long way since you boarded. We'll soon pass over the spot where you and I met. Then I suppose you'll leave us.
That's it, thought Forrest. He'd been wondering when he was due to disappear.
So be it.
The chief scientist worked in a surprisingly shabby old building in a heritage area close to the residence. He didn't seem overburdened with staff, either. Possibly chief scientist was a courtesy title? The minister for science, who had escorted Forrest only to be left twisting her tail in an anteroom, had been reticent on the subject. Forrest was ushered into a big, shiny laboratory full of expensive-looking equipment. A lizard man in a black smock and white pants, Venusian-style professional clothing, stood peering into a clear tank, affecting to be unaware of the visitor. They were alone, and Ezbui definitely was the guy Forrest had glimpsed in the mirror screen.
Come and look at this, sir. Look into the visor, and keep your hands to yourself.
Forrest walked over and obeyed. The tank seemed empty. Then tiny moving dots appeared and took on form, became twisting strands that divided and recombined. What do you see?
The living material of cell signatures?
Life, sir. On our world, all life is doomed. That is beyond doubt. But I have calculated that the third world has a biosphere, and my great project is to infect it. As soon as I've perfected my delivery system, those animacula will be injected through the clouds. They will cross the airless deeps, and something of us may survive.
A noble dream,
said Forrest politely. You don't believe me. How could one of us be an interplanetarian? You gave the master that orbit tracking toy for a joke, I'm sure. You forget that the skies above our levels were often clear before our habitats were launched. You overlook the fact that we cloud dwellers hold a wealth of astronomical knowledge, observations many thousands of years old.
I find Lakertan science very impressive.
The scientist stared unpleasantly, curling his lip in an ugly shadow of her smile.
How generous. I'm not one of the idiots who've been fawning over you, Mr. From the Sky. To me, the sky habitats are the enemy. The Wrapped are our natural allies. The sooner we can join the Empire, the better I'll be pleased, and I don't care if you take that message home.
My headset is malfunctioning, said Forrest, mugging puzzlement. I can't understand a word. I must try to come back another time. So sorry.
Forrest didn't need her to know he was a willing victim. Regrettably, he'd be safer if she didn't. But now he felt they had to have a frank discussion. Maybe it was a fatal, irresistible temptation. Be that as it may, luckily or unluckily, he knew the right venue for a meeting. In this city where she'd warned him everything he said and heard was monitored. He placed a personal call to Ezbui and left a message confirming his second visit to the lab, naming a time after Lakertan office hours. Falling asleep in the daytime was discouraged by incessant bursts of public music. A loud and melodious call to quiet relaxation was fading as Forrest entered the shabby old building. Nobody about. He stationed himself around the corner from the lab and waited. Sekhul arrived. He was right behind her as she unlocked the doors.
I thought that would smoke you out.
Excuse me? I was expecting to meet my brother.
I don't think he's going to turn up, said Forrest, following her inside.
He chased his spoken message with an automated cancellation, which she wouldn't have seen. Not that he cared if Ezbui came along. A frank exchange of views would be fine. Sek'ul, we need to talk, and I know this room is safe. I don't think even your crazy brother would have risked the kind of open sedition I heard from him earlier if Homeland Security were listening in. I knew this lab was firewalled anyway, he added deliberately. You made a video call from the Great Heart Refuge. I saw him in here when the two of you were planning how to use me in a hostage exchange. Her big green eyes got bigger, but she kept her head. No panic, no fluster.
So you know. All right. I was desperate. I decided to take matters into my own hands. I went hunting for a suitable opposition candidate. I ran into you and the plan changed.
Yeah. I was to be kinsnipped after you left. But then you had a better idea. I'm clear with all that. I just don't know why the hell Ezbui's involved. That arrogant idiot is going to destroy you, Sek'ul. Did you know he's seriously planning to sell this city to the Rapt? How do you think the Master, how do you think your people would like the sound of that?
Ezbui talks a lot of nonsense. Nobody listens. I needed his expertise.
But suddenly it was personal. There were two people who had been intensely intimate, but not very talkative. Here they were alone again, and the silence was falling apart.
And he has a right, said Sek'ul, her big eyes shamed and defiant. An inalienable right to help me recover our son's body.
My God. Are you saying your brother is your boy's father? She recoiled.
I know how it sounds, but John Forrest, I couldn't marry him. He was erratic even then. He had no reputation, he's no leader, he was totally unsuitable. I let myself get pregnant, but I married the Master. It made sense to me. My husband would die. I could never marry Ezbui. But he'd be beside me. Our son would inherit.
You learn something new every day, thought Forrest. So, talent gets courted and rewarded. Dynastic power stays with the blood royal. Maybe not such good sense to Ezbui.
Maybe not. I asked his help. I owed him that. It's illegal, of course. A simulacrum isn't supposed to have a lifespan, but the deal is acceptable. It's been accepted. What I did to you, to get what we needed, was theft, and I'm sorry.
A simulacrum, repeated Forrest, stunned. A flesh automaton.
Yes. A short-lived fleshly automaton for a dead boy. A fair trade, I thought, and we have a good chance of getting away with it. The Rapt refuse to admit they're holding Gemin, and they'd love to know more about the sky habitats, even what little they can learn from an ephemeral puppet, but they won't want to admit that side of the deal either.
So much for my heroics, thought Forrest. And she was bold, she was crazy reckless, his wood song, but maybe Forrest was the one who needed forgiving. Sek'ul, it's not going to work. I'm not what you think I am.
I know.
You know?
Of course. Ezbui's convinced you're a sky dweller, but he makes puppets. I'm a doctor. In my world, boy babies' tails are excised at birth or soon after. The non-existent gods only know why. Yours has never been excised. It's vestigial and internal. That's what I first noticed, but then your entire skeleton is different. Not deformed, different. Organs, too. Your cell signature is legible and obviously functional, but I've never seen anything like it. Maybe I took a mad risk, but I did you no harm and I thought you'd be far away and never know.
Her long smile broke out uncertainly.
I'm sure you have resources I can't imagine. Hidden somewhere in the sec where I found you.
No, I don't, said Forrest. No resources, ma'am. I'm a shipwrecked sailor. Her hand went to the pouch at her throat. She stared at him in amazement. Then a man screamed. A hideous sound, high-pitched, jagged, and brutal. Forrest looked wildly around the empty lab. But Sekhul leapt across the room and slapped her palm on a touchpad. The wall beside her opened silently. Within the space revealed, a naked man sat strapped to a chair, flushed and dripping sweat, a headset clasping his skull, tools of torture attached to his body. The chief scientist stood by, thoughtfully adjusting his instruments. The naked man was Forrest. Sekhul went up and stood over the chair. The Rapt would have been kinder. Esbri, you are disgusting. This was not in the bargain. What's he doing here? Snarled Esbri, backing away and glaring at Forrest. Now we'll have to eliminate the bastard, and that wasn't in the bargain.
I'd been living under a madman's heel, said Sekhul, in dawning wonder, taking out her knife. I did you a cruel injustice once, Esbri. I can't undo it. But enough is enough.
Esbri howled in fury. Don't touch it! It's mine! A lash of her tail sent him skidding into a wall. The knife plunged, violent and precise, into the hollow of the doll's collarbone. She stared at the wet ruin.
I don't know why I never realized, she murmured. I don't have to wait. I can seize power, I can make my own rules, give myself in place of Gemin if I must.
Don't talk like that, said Forrest.
Sekhul, when I thought you were going to hand me over in person, I was willing.
I'm still willing. I'll handle the hostage crisis. I've done the work before. Trust me, I'll bring your son's body home and I'll be fine.
Why would you do that, man from somewhere else?
Forrest, smiling with his eyes, drew her close and kissed her brow. But something was happening. Were the palace guards rushing in? No, it was in his hands. They were breaking up, vanishing. He felt a shock. Strangely familiar, this had happened to him before. It was Patolo's method. The sky raft must be over the drop zone. Sekhul, wait for me. I can't stop this, but I'll come back. She laid her hand against his heart.
I know.
Chapter 3. The Black Stone. When the orbits were aligned once more, John Forrest returned to West Africa to repeat his stunt for a select group of scientists. He arrived before the guests and joined Dr. Patolo, alone in the lab. Nothing much had changed in the room with the big windows looking out to the sunset horizon. John Forrest, dressed as before in wilderness kit, also seemed unchanged, except that he was in a better temper. That thing, he said, nodding at the oily black globe in its chamber. Your time travel gizmo. Does it have to be held like that, in the container?
No, it just has to be in the room.
What happens if I touch it? Sudden death? Radiation sickness?
You can touch it. I wouldn't advise you to keep it in your pocket for a week, said Patolo, a little bolder, a little less intimidated this time.
You're dispatching me to the exact place and time where you picked me up?
As requested, I'll be using the complex of space-time values recorded during the successful retrieval. But you should know, Mr. Forrest, it isn't that simple.
On the previous occasion, Forrest had disappeared at sunset and reappeared, mysteriously bedraggled, an hour before dawn. The interval, in local time, West Africa, did not necessarily indicate the length of his stay, or even prove that Forrest had arrived on the surface and Forrest was no help. It was puzzling. But the proof that the probe had visited a habitable ancient Venus was safely recorded in the data, and it was very, very convincing.
You still remember nothing?
Forrest puckered his lower lip and shook his head. Nothing at all, alas.
We'll do better this time. We have a memory retrieval brain scanner on hand. We'll pluck the images straight from your head before they can vanish.
Forrest smiled politely, thinking of Sekhul, the sorceress. Her promise, which he was about to put to the test.
The guests assembled. There was some chatter, some flattery. He stood in the gate. All eyes were on the human element in the apparatus. Nobody noticed that the globe had gone from its place. Hands in his pockets, he looked to the west, where Hawa herself was lost in cloud, but the stars that he would never see again were beginning to shine out. The world disappeared.
Joe Haldeman. Here's a pilot on a desperate rescue mission after a disaster on Venus, who soon finds that he might need rescuing himself, and who makes a discovery that changes everything we know about life. Born in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, Joe Haldeman took a BS degree in physics and astronomy from the University of Maryland and did postgraduate work in mathematics and computer science. But his plans for a career in science were cut short by the U.S. Army, which sent him to Vietnam in 1968 as a combat engineer. Seriously wounded in action, Haldeman returned home in 1969 and began to write. He sold his first story to Galaxy in 1969, and by 1976 had garnered both the Nebula Award and the Hugo Award for his famous novel, The Forever War, one of the landmark books of the 70s. He took another Hugo Award in 1977 for his story Tricentennial, won the Reisling Award in 1984 for the best science fiction poem of the year. Although usually thought of primarily as a hard science writer, Haldeman is in fact also an accomplished poet and has sold poetry to most of the major professional markets in the genre, and won both the Nebula and the Hugo Award in 1991 for the novella version of The Hemingway Hoax. His story, None So Blind, won the Hugo Award in 1995. His other books include a mainstream novel, War Year, the SF novels, Mind Bridge, All My Sins Remembered, There Is No Darkness, written with his brother, SF writer Jack C. Haldeman II, Worlds, Worlds Apart, Worlds Enough and Time, Buying Time, The Hemingway Hoax, Tools of the Trade, The Coming, the mainstream novel 1968, Camouflage, which won the prestigious James Tiptree Jr. Award, Old 20th, The Accidental Time Machine, Mars Bound, and Starbound. His short work has been gathered in the collections Infinite Dreams, Dealing in Futures, Vietnam and Other Alien Worlds, None So Blind, A Separate War and Other Stories, and an omnibus of fiction and nonfiction, War Stories. As editor, he has produced the anthologies Study War No More, Cosmic Laughter, Nebula Award Stories 17, and with Martin H. Greenberg, Future Weapons of War. His most recent books are a new science fiction novel, Earthbound, a big retrospective collection, The Best of Joe Haldeman, and a novel, Work Done for Hire. Haldeman lives part of the year in Boston, where he teaches writing at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and the rest of the year in Florida, where he and his wife, Gay, make their home.
Living Hell by Joe Haldeman. Read for you by W. Morgan Shepherd. Maybe I should have stayed on Mars. That's a sentiment repeated so often here on Venus, it's right up there with, I should have read the fine print. About a third of the people here first did a stint on Mars, and I guess we thought that Venus had to be better. Wrong as rain, and Venus is rain. There are dry periods up by the poles, but we don't go there. No plants. And the equator is wind-driven steam that would flay the flesh from your skeleton. Only girls went there, heavily armored, and robots, and telepresence. They could employ robots up here in the so-called temperate zone, too, but people are supposedly cheaper in the long run. Made with unskilled labor, as the saying goes, but more or less teachable. Plus the advantage of unquantifiable factors like imagination and initiative, and the supposition that a team is more than the sum of its parts, versatility and initiative. You can program a machine to solve 1,000 different problems, and you hope it becomes a machine for finding the 1,001st. This team found more than it bargained for. Humans as individuals are fallible in their own ways, with errors less predictable than those of machines. But the other side of that is being able to see problems that didn't appear to be problems, and once in a great while, solutions that don't appear to be solutions. We were almost killed by that virtue back when humans were new here. People call it the second wave now, which is a little grandiose and hopeful, since if there was a first wave, it consisted of only 8 people, 5 of them eventually buried under the planet's muddy soil. Buried is a kind of euphemism, since anything edible is dug up immediately and integrated into the lively Venusian ecology. But cremation's not a real option, not with everything ringing wet, surrounded by hardly enough oxygen to keep a match lit. Did I mention that it's not a garden spot? Though it is full of plants. I wrote into my will that if I die here, they should just put my body outside with a nice ribbon tied around some appendage. Use the ribbon from my PhD diploma, finally giving it a useful purpose. On the way to and from Mars, I accumulated 30 credit hours and wrote a dissertation on anomalies in heat transfer models in extreme environments, like the one I was going to enjoy on the planet of steam and stink. The girls who work down toward the equator have to stalk around in heavy plastic armor, but the air in their suits is cool and sweet. I applied for that assignment, but I think was automatically disqualified, not really for being male, but for not weighing less than 100 pounds. They're all tiny and cute, and when you talk to them on the cube, they're not wearing too much. My friend Gloria, who works down there, lamented that it smells like a woman's locker room with no perfume. I imagine that I could handle that, compared to the rotting greenhouse, but was smart enough not to say anything. I wouldn't have any reason to go down there anyhow. You might ask why someone with a physical science doctorate finds himself with a job collecting biota on an alien planet, but that would prove that you didn't know a lot about the intersection of science and bureaucracy. Half a lifetime ago, I got a bachelor's in environmental engineering, because that's where the jobs were, but then went on to aero-astro. So, of course, when the wheels of the gods ground out this assignment for me, they saw the ENV-ENG and ignored the fact that I did go on to the physics doctorate and have forgotten more biology than I ever learned. The transfer orbit we took from Mars to Venus lasted 6 months, and I did take 2 biology courses en route. But I also wanted to finish my dissertation before I forgot all my thermophysics. So I absorbed just enough xenobiology to avoid touching plants that would kill me. You don't need any coursework to avoid the animals that would. While I was up in orbit, we got a message from a movie guy asking about doing a Venus-based remake of the classic Jurassic Park. Much hilarity ensued. Someone remembered a joke about the difference between a producer in science and one in Hollywood. A producer in science needs decades of education, not to mention intelligence and dedication, so he or she can produce something. A producer in Hollywood just needs a phone. Oh, and no one was ever eaten by a special effects monster. In fact, when we studied the macrofauna of Venus, it was with the understanding that for every animal that had a name, there were 2 or 3 that hadn't yet made their presence known. Some very macro, and either good at hiding, or so macro they wouldn't even notice killing you. My favorite is the flying carpet, both big and almost invisible underfoot. It looks like a large rug that's contracted a skin disease, which means that it doesn't look that different from most of the ground. You can stroll right over it, and it doesn't move until you're in the middle of its several square meters. Then it tries to roll itself up with you inside. Your warning is an enzyme that smells like rotten apple juice. If you smell that, you have about 0.5 seconds to jump back the way you came, because that enzyme ain't apple juice. The microfauna have had less success in incorporating us into the food chain. except for whatever the crotch eaters like, our body chemistry isn't compatible. The creatures who eat us get very sick, which seems only fair. I suppose that they would eventually develop an aversion to us, but Harnia, our only actual xenobiologist, says that's not likely. Too many monsters and too few of us for them to eat and throw up. Thus, not enough learning opportunities. She would remind me that humans are the monsters here. I'll persist in species chauvinism and call a monster a monster. I remembered a point that my high school biology teacher made. A prey animal that's taken by a predator obviously can never communicate the knowledge of having been killed that way to the next generation. But a prey animal that does survive the encounter may communicate the thrill of the chase. Presumably the abstraction, "that was close, better not do that again," is too complex for their ungulate brains. But they do observe and learn. A complex example on Earth was a tribe of burrowing creatures, meerkats, who would dive into their holes if humans approached carrying guns, but would ignore humans carrying shovels. That was language behavior as well as perception and discrimination. The meerkat who was the lookout had different sounds for armed and unarmed humans. There's nothing as innocent as ungulates or meerkats here. If they were cute, fuzzy little burrowing animals, they would drink blood or give off a poison gas, or both. The little disaster that led to the current trouble was the local space elevators falling down. Earth's space elevator is as safe as the one at Macy's, but Earth doesn't have Venusian weather. One cable unraveled, then another, and it's a good thing they'd put the equatorial station to the east of the damn thing, or it might have flattened all the human females on the planet. One of them did die in the storm of whipping cables and metal shreds. Two storage modules were destroyed, one with most of their food, and their shuttle was sliced in two. They couldn't survive for long on the planet, and they had no way off. So the wisdom of redundancy was made clear. Each base had the wherewithal to keep both crews alive for longer than it would take for help to arrive from Earth. Most of those resources were duplicated again up at Midway, the unmanned synchronous satellite that was the nexus for the space elevator. Midway probably wasn't hurt when the elevator took its little trip, but it was suddenly a very expensive destination in terms of fuel. My shuttlecraft is bimodal as an economy measure. It can fly around in the atmosphere of Venus or in the vacuum of outer space. In the miserly atmosphere, it concentrates oxygen from the planet's thin air soup as it sputters along, but it's nothing like a terrestrial turbojet. A lot of energy from the engine goes right back into extracting oxygen. And if I fly too high, the oxygen concentrator seizes up. The first-person pronoun there is unfortunately accurate. When the storm hit, there was nobody else pilot-certified at the temperate base. There wouldn't really be room for a co-pilot anyhow, once I picked up the wind. So my trip south was solo, slow and tense. Most of the time I was flying low over ferocious electrical storms, so the ride was bumpy until I got high enough, and the radio was useless with static. I did sporadically get through enough to know that the surviving women were safe for now, inside the living module of their shuttle, but of course it wasn't flyable. We didn't discuss the other dangers. There were thunder lizards big and strong enough to tear through the light metal skin of the ship. It was great for keeping vacuum out and protecting against micrometeoroids, but even I, with merely human strength, could tear a hole into it with a crowbar and tin snips. The biggest lizards were half the size of the ship. If they thought there was something good to eat inside, they wouldn't need to look around for a can opener. The women had guns, as we did, but they wouldn't have much value, even as noisemakers. The environment was full of dangerous-sounding noises. You can shoot at the native life all day, and it's just target practice. Dumb as rocks. They don't know somebody's shooting at them. If you hit them, They don't even know they're dead. They did shoot 3 or 4 of the beasts when they first landed. All that meat lying around rotting kept the other creatures occupied for a while, and most of them grew cautious enough to stay away from the ship at least during the day. At night, there would be a lot of feeding and fighting, but during the day, the larger meat-eaters mostly slept. The women were doing fine in their way, and the men in theirs, for about a Venusian year, 9 Earth months. And then the sun decided to misbehave. It's not as if we hadn't had solar flares before. They screw up everything for a couple of days, but you basically power down and play cards until the storm is over. This was a super flare, though, the largest one recorded this century. It even shut down communications on Mars, let alone Earth and Venus. Mercury Station had time to broadcast 3 words, or 2.5. Look out, FLA. It was not a warning for Florida. 10 hours later, the coronal mass ejection from the flare hit us. Quantum electronics went south. Solid-state circuits became really solid, as infused. Switches welded shut. Radios became paperweights. The shuttle had been designed with a fallback manual mode that required no electronics. Of course, I'd never used it except in a training simulator. The ship even had a paper print manual which gave off a whiff of mildew when I opened it. I'd studied it well enough to be certified 20 years ago, and I could read the parts that were English. Most of the math was gibberish to a normal person. Could I navigate well enough to find the women? Yes and no. Venus does have a pole star, but you might have to wait a few years for a break in the clouds to align with it. Or go above the clouds. There was a manual fuel feed by a forward-facing port, along with an airspeed indicator and a visual fuel gauge. Of course, the gauge only told you how many liters of fuel you had left, not how far you could get on them. The manual had appendices in the back that told you how much fuel the tub burned per second, at full throttle, half throttle, and stall. The calculator Bucky printed on the page was useless without power, but luckily someone had had a sense of humor. There was an old-fashioned slide rule in a wall module like a fire alarm. In case of emergency, break glass. Ha! Ha! I used the butt of my pistol to gain access to lower mathematics. There were several blank pages in the back of the manual, and in a MISC drawer, I found an old pencil with an eraser. I couldn't make the eraser work. I guess the battery was dead. But with the tables in the back of the manual and the slide rule, I figured we had 27 minutes of full acceleration, more than enough to get to Midway and refuel for Earth transfer. Of course, the electronics on Midway would be useless. I could fly to it and dock by the seat of my pants, but could I get inside? Take care of that when we get there, I guess. The most economical Hohmann transfer would get us to Earth orbit in as little as 6 months. I packed 4.5 crates of freeze-dry in the shuttle, all I had at the one-man base, buckled up, and took off. I took a suborbital trajectory up high enough to be in space, kind of, and found the South Celestial Pole in between Ursa Minor and Draco, oriented the ship to pointing nose south, and dove back down. The equatorial station was fortunately at the intersection of an Amazon-sized river and a big brown sea, so I could just follow the sea's coastline down to the river and look around. That would be simple if it were a nice, clear day. Venus never has one. Buffeted by storm winds, I had my hands full keeping visual contact with the coastline while the ship pitched and yawed through driving rain. Too frequent lightning glared every few seconds. I didn't expect to see the space elevator cable, less than a meter thick, until it's close to the base. But you could easily see where it had fallen, a straight brown line of dead vegetation. When the map showed I was near the base, I dropped to treetop level and crawled along dead slow. They damn near shot me down. A signal flare exploded just off my port wing, and by reflex, I slapped the smart descend. In the absence of electronics, that was not smart. It killed the engine, and I was a very heavy glider for about 8 seconds. I tried for the beach and almost made it. Branches slapped and scraped and did break my fall. I gouged up about 30 meters of sand and came to a stop just before finding out whether the thing would work as a submarine or an anchor. In fact, I wasn't too badly situated. Pointed seaward with the shuttle's nose slightly elevated, I eased the throttle forward a fraction of a millimeter, and it did fire up and move me a little nudge. So, if I had to, I could get away fast. In a bin marked survival gear, I found a web belt with two canteens and a holstered pistol. Filled the canteens and put a full magazine in the pistol. There were 10 more full magazines in a cardboard box. I dumped them into a camo knapsack along with some food bars. There was also a heavy machine gun, too big to lift comfortably with one hand. Overkill, unless I was attacked by an infantry platoon. The pistol was an old-fashioned powder type, flash and smoke and big boom. Maybe it would startle some monster enough to give it indigestion after it ate my arm. Actually, as a usually observant vegetarian, I didn't feel good about the prospect of blasting away to innocent animals. But I didn't want to become part of the food chain myself either. I hoped I was within a few miles of where the girls had called from. The radio was all white noise and crackle, but I shouted a description of my situation into it anyhow. They had probably heard the shuttle come screaming in and crash. Would they come towards the sound? I suppose I would, in their situation. Or maybe split into two groups, one staying put, and the other going off to search for my smoldering remains. In any case, my most obvious course was to stay put myself, for at least as long as it would take for them to get here. So, of course, I went outside. Or, to be fair, I did sit in the semi-darkness of the emergency lighting for as long as I could stand it, maybe 5 minutes. I drew the heavy pistol and opened the door just wide enough to see outside. Nothing slithered into the ship, so I opened it wide enough to exit and studied the jungle for several minutes. The ripe and rotten smell conquered the shuttle's air conditioning pretty thoroughly, but there was no sign of life bigger than an insect, though that might mean the size of your foot on Venus. It was a short jump to the ground. My boots sank 2 inches into the mud. I aimed around for targets of opportunity, a cheerful and optimistic phrase. None appeared, so I pulled a rain hat down tight and made a careful circle around the ship. It didn't appear to be greatly damaged. The leading edge of its wings had a couple of dents, which would limit re-entry speed for atmospheric braking, but once I got off this blasted planet, I didn't really plan on returning. When I got back to Earth, I'd just take the elevator down, leave this tub in orbit for Solar System Enterprises to sell for salvage. A snake I hadn't seen reared up to about belt level. I fired reflexively, and it flew away. A flying snake? Maybe it was just gliding, technically. Bad enough. The snake had a face, sort of smiling, and bright yellow antennae or horns. What a charming planet. I hadn't hit it, but the noise made my ears ring and the pistol's recoil had smacked my palm like a baseball bat. I wasn't going to be blasting away like some hero in a cowboy movie. I almost didn't hear the girl's answering shot, surely less than a mile away. I fired again and listened carefully while I reloaded 2 fat cartridges. I yelled, "Hello!" a couple of times at the top of my lungs. I went back to the shuttle's stern. The primary blast nozzle was wider than I am tall, so nothing was likely to sneak up behind me. It was still radiating heat and creaking as it cooled, which might also discourage animals. Unless they thought, "That thing is lying still and squeaking helplessly."